You can find information about subscribing to this series at netrf.org/podcast, where you'll also find a bunch of helpful charts, graphs, and videos that expand on this material. If you like this show and find it helpful, please leave a review on whatever app you're using to listen to it, and we'd love to get your feedback at podcast@netrf.org. Welcome to NetWise. This is a podcast for neuroendocrine cancer patients and caregivers that presents expert information and patient perspectives. My name is Lauren Heider from the Neuroendocrine Tumor Research Foundation. As we talked about in the last episode, diagnosing NETs is really tricky. It can involve many doctors doing multiple tests to rule out more common diseases. This can be a frustrating process, but unfortunately, it's necessary. Here's Dr. Mark Lewis, Director of Gastrointestinal Oncology at Intermountain Healthcare, a system of hospitals in Utah and Idaho.
Primary care in particular is difficult. It gets grossly underrated. It's not as glamorous as, say, neurosurgery. But primary care doctors are the first line of defense for patients. And this is how I've heard their job described. Imagine you're standing by a train track and you're watching a train go by and you're looking at faces at the window and it's all a blur. And you have to pick out the one person who's sick. That to me is a perfect analogy for the NET patient. You may see 30 cases of irritable bowel syndrome and one of those people actually has carcinoid syndrome and you've got to pick them out. So a lot of NET patients have had the experience of misdiagnosis or delayed diagnosis.
This episode is all about information. How do your doctors gather the information they need to correctly diagnose your tumor and recommend the right course of treatment? NETs are complex. There are multiple options for diagnostics and surveillance. On a basic level, your doctors are trying to describe your tumor in a way that other doctors and members of your care team can understand. This description includes some elements we talked about last time. Where is your cancer? What is its stage, meaning has it metastasized? Then we're going to add new descriptors. Your tumor's grade, and is it well or poorly differentiated? More about those in a moment, but first, let's talk about all the ways your doctors will gather the information they need to make these assessments. It almost always begins with imaging. Taking pictures of the inside of your body to find the tumors and begin to learn about them and how they behave. This can be done in several ways. Some kinds of imaging like x-rays, CAT scans, and MRIs, they're anatomical, meaning they allow doctors to see the shape and structure of a particular part of the body. And some are functional, meaning they show something about chemical reactions happening inside cells. Here's Dr. Richard Wall, head of the Department of Radiology at Washington University School of Medicine in St. Louis.
As radiologists and clinicians, we have a bunch of ways to look for tumors in the body. We have options of looking anatomically. That is, like, is there a mass or not? Or functionally, or sort of a hybrid of both.
The first step for most doctors who are trying to diagnose something they think may be a NET is often an anatomical scan, called a CAT or CT scan, which stands for computerized tomography. CT scans are basically x-rays, but rather than a single flat image, the machine takes multiple x-rays from different angles. Those images are then assembled by a computer into a three-dimensional picture. Here's Dr. Pamela Kuntz, director of the Neuroendocrine Tumor Program at Stanford University, followed by Dr. Rathan Subramaniam, professor of radiology and chief of nuclear medicine at University of Texas Southwestern Medical Center in Dallas.
So a CT scan, a patient will lay on an exam table with a sort of tube around them, and pictures are taken using x-rays, and those pictures are then put together that provide a three-dimensional view of the body, and it's often done of the area where they're pointing to, it hurts here.
It's similar to, like the slices in a loaf of bread. So it takes images almost like slices through the human body and allows us to see almost every part of human body, including bones, blood vessels, all the organs inside, and it can go from head to toe. And it's a very quick examination in the sense it can be done from head to toe within a few minutes.
Another kind of scan is called an MRI. That's short for magnetic resonance imaging. These use magnetic fields instead of radiation.
It's a totally different kind of imaging test. It's a technique that uses magnetic fields and radio waves to create detailed images of the organs and tissues within the human body.
They're both usually done with a form of contrast, which means that a patient will get an IV line and a medication infused through that IV line. And that contrast goes through the blood vessels and helps enhance different features of the body depending on what contrast is used.
These two scans use different technologies, so they see different things. And there are kinds of nets that will show up clearly on a CT, but not be seen at all on an MRI, and vice versa. Here's Dr. Sumit Vermani, a radiologist at Rush University Medical Center in Chicago.
It really depends on the tumor location. If the patient has a pancreatic tumor, this is well delineated on the MR. If the patient has a hepatic tumor, it can be seen on both MR and CT. If the patient has a small bowel tumor, it will not be picked up on the MR. So each modality has its positives and negatives.
As we mentioned, there's also an entirely different kind of imaging that radiologists can do, functional imaging. Instead of looking at the physical structure of a part of the body, they make pictures of the internal activity of cells. A commonly used kind of functional scan is called a PET, or positron emissions tomography scan. When functional scans are combined with anatomical scans, a hybrid image can be built that gives a rich view of both tumor activity and location. This is called PET CT, positron emission tomography and computed tomography.
And a PET CT scan, when we say PET CT scan, it's combined these two different modalities, a PET scan as well as a CT scan. What it does is it gives us much more clarity where this chemical reaction or where is taking place. So when we look at those scans, we can pinpoint exactly which part of the body it's taking place. That's why the CT scan combined with the PET scan is a really valuable test.
To find and scan activity in tumor cells, a radio tracer is used. These work because particular kinds of cells have an affinity for some chemicals, attracting them and processing them. This is referred to as the cells having receptors or expressing receptors for that chemical.
There are different type of cells or tumor cells expresses different type of receptors or antigens on their cell surface. And they are intrinsic to those tumors.
Now, if you take some of that chemical and attach it to a small amount of radioactive material, you've made a radio tracer. Then, when you release that compound into the bloodstream, it will seek out the cells that have those particular receptors. Then, on the scans, the cells that express those receptors literally light up.
It shows the higher levels of chemical activity, that's what it is. These areas show up as bright spots in the scan.
You may have heard of an FDG PET CT scan. This scan shows how active tumor cells are using a radio tracer called 18F fluorodeoxyglucose. This can be an effective scan for some cancers. Activity can be measured by understanding how fast tumor cells use up a sugar called glucose. More active tumor cells use more glucose and light up brighter on this scan. The catch is that slow-growing NETs, they're just less active than other cancers, and they may not light up brightly or not at all. Luckily, there are other options for NETs using a different radio tracer. Many neuroendocrine tumors do express receptors for a hormone called somatostatin. Somatostatin is a growth hormone that helps to control the endocrine system. Here's Dr. Ed Wolin, an oncologist who's the director of the Center for Carcinoid and Neuroendocrine Tumors at Mount Sinai Medical Center in New York City.
Somatostatin is a natural hormone in the body. It binds to a somatostatin receptor, which is on the membrane of certain cells. 80 to 90% of neuroendocrine tumors have somatostatin receptors. Natural somatostatin binds very well to the receptor, and so does its analogs. And then after binding to the receptor, it internalizes inside the cell and gets stuck inside the cell where it exerts its actions.
This is especially useful because very few other cells, except neuroendocrine tumors, have this characteristic. So if we release artificial somatostatin, called a somatostatin analog, into the bloodstream, it will seek out any nets that are in the body and stick to them. As we'll hear in a later episode, this is the basis for several kinds of useful treatments for nets. It's also behind a new kind of imaging, which has only been available for use in the United States since 2016, something called a gallium-68 dotatate PET CT.
When patients go in for this newer scan, they get an injection of a material with a protein called octreotide and a very low dose of radiation called gallium-68. And the gallium-68 serves as a light bulb so that when it's infused, the gallium-68 and the octreotide attach to that somatostatin receptor like a lock and a key. So it's a very specific relationship. And so in doing so, when the gallium-68 attaches to the cancer cell and we take a picture, it lights up like a light bulb where the cancer cells are in the body.
You may have also heard of a scan called octreoscan, which has been available in the United States since the early 1990s. The octreoscan uses a similar mechanism to light up neuroendocrine tumor cells using somatostatin, but it uses a different radio tracer than the dotatate gallium scan, and there are major differences between the two.
So octreotide scan has been there since 1994. It was approved by FDA in 1994, and we were very happy that we are able to see a lot of lesions. But when gallium-68 dotatate PET CT came, it proved that we were all wrong, and there were a lot of lesions that we were missing by on octreotide. It's a quicker scan. It takes about 2 hours as compared to the octoscan, which usually takes about 2 to 3 days. It has better images. It's very highly sensitive. The images are very clear, crisp, high resolution.
And in just the few years since gallium scans have become available in the US, they have already become essential to the way NETs are diagnosed and treated. They are particularly useful because they can help find tumors that might otherwise be missed. Here's Caroline Creamer, a physician assistant who works with NET patients at the University of Pennsylvania Medical Center.
The gallium scans are really important with an initial diagnosis because it gives us a good idea of where the primary is and if there is any spread of disease, and if so, where that spread is. It helps determine if they're a surgical candidate or if, you know, we can tackle their disease with liver-directed therapies and basically how we can kind of target treatment.
Gallium scans can also be extremely useful for finding the extent of metastases, which is invaluable for doing things like planning surgery. Here's Dr. George Fisher, who specializes in treating NET patients at Stanford University Medical Center.
If a surgeon was going to go in and do a big liver surgery, but in fact found spots elsewhere that were concerning, the surgeon might think twice about doing a big liver surgery if he knows that there's going to be disease outside the liver that would be neglected, or that surgeon might say, well, I can go get that too. So if the gallium dotatate scan found a spot in the tail of the pancreas, the surgeon says, that's no problem. I'll go ahead and take out the spots in the liver that I can see on that scan, and I'll take out the spot in the pancreas that I might not have otherwise seen.
As exciting as this new technology is, it isn't perfect. First, some radiologists in the United States, they've only been looking at these for a couple of years, and they can be tricky to read. Here's Bonnie Bennett, the nurse coordinator for the NET treatment program at Penn.
It's a newer technology here in the United States, and our radiologists are getting used to reading it. And oftentimes at tumor board, we will look at the scan together with our radiologists. There may be something that's lighting up, but they're saying, no, that's just interference, or that's just physiologic activity. That's one thing that I think people don't understand when they read it on their report. It says there's physiologic activity in the thyroid and the liver and all of these different organs, and they think, oh my, I have tumor everywhere. But it's just the radio tracer going normally through the tissues that's being picked up, but it isn't isn't avid. It isn't being picked up so that it glows brightly and it's an actual tumor site.
Second, and more importantly, some NETs do not have somatostatin receptors. And those NETs, they do not light up on the scan.
Even in an individual patient, you can have instances where, let's say, the majority of the lesions are receptor positive, and then there's a minority that are somatostatin receptor negative. So increasingly, we are what we call metabolically or functionally phenotyping these lesions using our scans to figure out, are they all SS somatostatin receptor positive, or is there a subset that's not positive for the receptor, but that are in fact there and alive that we're going to miss if we give a targeted therapy?
Another way doctors might take pictures of your tumor is with actual photos or video recordings using a technique called endoscopy. Here's Dr. Eloisa Suarez, head of the neuroendocrine tumor program at the University of New Mexico in Albuquerque.
So when the patient is going for endoscopy, he will meet with the with a physician that provides that, such as a gastroenterologist, or sometimes our surgeon can do as well. They will receive some anesthesia to sedate them a little bit. Typically, it's not general anesthesia, it's just something to sedate the patients. They will then be laying on a table, and a camera, it will be introduced either through their mouth or through their anus, and look for disease, which could be, you know, for a tumor or for inflammation, if the reason for that procedure is a little bit different.
This procedure is particularly useful for gathering information about NETs in the lungs, which can be accessed easily via the mouth and throat, and NETs in the rectum and large intestine, which can be accessed through the anus. It's much less useful for mid-gut NETs, like in the small intestine or pancreas, because they're harder to get to. Endoscopy is not nearly as invasive as surgery, but it's more involved than a scan, and so it requires a little more preparation on the part of the patient.
That is a outpatient procedure, but the patients need to come fasting. Then often, especially if they're doing a colonoscopy, which is to look, again, in the colon and in the rectum, they have to have some preparation for to have the bowel clean, so there's not stools, because if you have stools when you're going with the camera, then it's, you can miss a tumor. If you have your stomach full of food when you're going for the for an upper endoscopy, for example, is not good, right? Because the food will also potentially mask a tumor, in addition to putting you at risk of aspiration, which is not good.
Using biochemical tests, such as lab tests with blood and urine, can be a bit tricky. They are not as useful for diagnosing NETs as scans or biopsies, but they can be helpful for monitoring disease progression. A 5-HIAA test measures the amount of serotonin in the blood. Elevated levels of serotonin can be associated with a NET that is causing carcinoid syndrome. To perform this test, urine is collected in a container over a 24-hour time period.
You decide, well, I'm going to just ask for this 24-hour urine collection and see if there's an elevated marker called 5-HIAA, which is a metabolite of serotonin. And if the serotonin is causing the flushing and or the diarrhea, I might find a high level of 24-hour 5-HIAA in a urine collection. Then I can say, well, if that's high, I think that this is probably a carcinoid syndrome, and I'll go ahead and do the workup to look for a carcinoid tumor.
To avoid inaccurate results, certain foods and over-the-counter medicines should be avoided for 3 to 7 days before the 24-hour test.
Because there are some medications and some foods that can potentially increase a little bit the levels in the urine. So you should restrict yourself to a specific diet for that.
Some foods to avoid include bananas, avocados, plums, eggplants, tomatoes, plantains, pineapples, and walnuts and cashews. Also avoid tea, coffee, and alcohol. Over-the-counter medicines you should avoid include cough medicines, Tylenol, and aspirin. A chromogranin A test is a blood test measuring CGA, a protein found in neuroendocrine tumors.
I think the most common one and the one that the patients ask the most and physicians order the most is called chromogranin A. It's a peptide that the neuroendocrine tumor cells, they secrete, and then it circulates in the blood. You measure that in the blood, and then there are studies that show that could be associated with the amount of disease that a patient has, and also some correlation with survival. The caveat is that the sensitivity and the specificity of the test is very variable. What is the specificity is that if I have the test, does that really mean that I have the disease? Not necessarily, because there is a lot of false positives, meaning that there are other conditions that can increase your chromogranin level that are not necessarily related to neuroendocrine tumors. You know, renal disease, someone that has a bad kidney, that can increase your chromogranin A levels. Someone that has bad heart disease. Also, if you are taking what's called PPI or proton pump inhibitors because you have heartburn, that can also increase your levels of chromogranin A.
People in the community might have, you know, one episode of flushing or what, two episodes of loose stool, and their doctor, who may have exquisite awareness of neuroendocrine tumors or carcinoid, will go ahead and get a chromogranin A, and it'll be sky high, and then they'll refer them to me because they think they have a carcinoid tumor. In fact, most of those patients don't have a carcinoid tumor because they may have been taking some antacid, some pill to help decrease secretion of acid in their stomach. And as a consequence of that, they can have a markedly elevated chromogranin A that has nothing to do with a tumor.
My name is Samuel Prentice, Jr. Basically, what happened was in 2002, I had a blockage in my small intestine. And so up until that time, I had never had any health issues. At that time, I was 57 or something like that, I believe. And had never had any health issues at all. And what happened was I developed a 72-hour case of the hiccups. Basically, I went out for dinner on Friday night, woke up on Saturday morning, and, you know, with the hiccups, you know, continued all through the day, went to urgent care. They gave me kind of like a hiccup suppression type of thing, and that seemed to help a little bit. But then Sunday they started in again, and then so I ended up back in the hospital on Sunday. And that's when they put a gastrointestinal tube down me and everything, and then started doing their diagnosis and their tests and so on, and said that there was a blockage. And so ended up in the hospital and having to have surgery, and they removed a 2-inch tumor from my small intestine that they told me was cancerous. There wasn't any other evidence of cancer at all, so they just took out that 2 inches of my small intestine. And sold me back up and said, you know, it's important to follow up with oncologists and everything in terms of getting ongoing tests. And so that's what I did. I think it was, 2 months later, I had another blood test and urine test. And that continued on basically for the following year. About every 2 or 3 months, I would have this blood urine test and so on. Then it went to 4 months and then 6 months. And then they finally, after about 3 years, they did another CT scan and they said they didn't find anything. And so I could just go ahead and just have a yearly, physical and include the urine test and the blood test, with that. And then I'd have an annual checkup and everything. And again, the blood test, urine test came back fine. And there didn't seem to be any problem whatsoever. Nobody had ever mentioned to me that it was a neuroendocrine tumor. I never heard of the term NET or carcinoid. Then 2017, so 15 years later, what happened was I ended up having to go to the hospital because I was having significant gastrointestinal distress, lots and lots of pain and bloating and that sort of thing, and something that I had not had. What happened then was that I ended up going in and having the surgery, and there was just this myriad of scar tissue all around my GI tract. And so they had to take out 9 feet of my small intestine, including my ileum, and the connection to, with my colon and my appendix. And then, and that was the bad news. I had a 5-hour surgery with, you know, all this plumbing removed. The good news was, if you can call it good news, was that they discovered that there was carcinoid cancer there. And because the test results had not indicated that, the blood and the urine test had not indicated that. So I didn't know that, that I had it. And in fact, that it had kind of spread through my GI tract and metastasized to my liver. And the reason why that was, why it was so providential from my standpoint is that when they went in, not only did they discover that there was scar tissue, you know, about, but that actually there had been a puncturing of my small intestine. I was starting to develop, become septic. And if I'd waited another 24, 48 hours, I said, well, you know, I just kind of, you know, I'll wait and kind of tough this out or something like that and so on. You know, I would have died. My life started revolving around healthcare appointments. It just revolves around appointments to the different specialists, oncologists and GI doctor, and of course in the aftermath of my surgery, the surgeon, dietitian, physical occupational therapist, blood draw, and then tests. You know, I mean, there's been all sorts of CT scans, MRIs, echograms, just lots and lots of tests. So your life starts to revolve then around, okay, you know, what, you know, is going on this week as far as, you know, some sort of test or doctor's appointment or physical therapy or whatever and so on and so forth.
The next step is almost always a biopsy. A biopsy is a procedure that removes a small sample of tissue or fluid. This sample might be obtained by means of an endoscope, or by using a long needle, or sometimes by surgery.
Biopsies, when they're not done surgically, are usually done by an interventional radiologist who uses a needle with a small core. And this, for example, let's say we're doing a liver biopsy because someone may have cancer spots in the liver. Their skin would get numbed up. The interventional radiologist use a scan, either an ultrasound or a CT scan, to help guide where they're putting the needle so that that needle goes into exactly where they want it. They take some samples of that, and then that gets sent to the pathologist. It is cut into very, very thin slices and placed on a slide, and then the pathologist can look at that under the microscope, and they will look at, number one, what do the cells look like? Number two, they do a whole series of special stains that help identify maybe where did it come from, what type of cancer is it. We rely very heavily on our pathologists.
A pathologist examines the biopsy sample to make a diagnosis. And to the expert eye of a pathologist, a net looks very distinctive, quite different from both the healthy cells that surround it and from other tumors. Here's Dr. Attur Singhi, a pathologist at the University of Pittsburgh Medical Center in Pennsylvania.
Typically, the healthy cells within the small intestines or the pancreas, they're ordered, but they're small, they're inconspicuous, and as opposed to the neuroendocrine neoplasm, which just expands. It continues to grow, but it's a very well encapsulated, very circumferential neoplasm. It's not ill-defined. It's very distinct. And then as you look at closer power, you start seeing the nuclei. And the nuclei are extremely distinct when it comes to neuroendocrine neoplasm. They have that what we call a salt and pepper chromatin appearance. And so when you mix salt and pepper, they have a very kind of coarse architecture, where you see larger bits of pepper amongst little fragments of salt, and it's very distinct. As opposed to, let's say, an adenocarcinoma or squamous cell carcinoma or melanoma, where the nuclei are very prominent, pleomorphic, big, gigantic, very mitotically active. In contrast, a neuroendocrine neoplasm is typically very inconspicuous, uniform. They don't hardly grow very fast. I mean, they're very slow-growing neoplasms.
In addition to confirming that we are, in fact, dealing with a neuroendocrine tumor, pathologists can also make determinations about the differentiation and grade of tumor cells, which is crucial information for your doctors to decide what's next. Differentiation, as it sounds, has to do with how alike or different the cancer cells are from the healthy cells around them. You see, any new cell, when it first divides, it begins as what's called a stem cell, a cell that has the potential to become a part of any kind of tissue. The cell then differentiates to fulfill a particular function, becoming part of your skin or blood or lungs or whatever is required.
So that gets back to embryology, and cancer is where embryology goes wrong. When you start with stem cells, which the ultimate is the embryo from the egg and the sperm, that's an undifferentiated state. As cells mature, they have to become functional components of some organ.
Cancer cells sometimes successfully differentiate, looking and functioning a lot like the cells of the surrounding tissue. And sometimes they don't, looking like something else entirely.
So when you look at a sample of tumor under the microscope, any tumor, any kind of cancer, those cells may or may not try to emulate the tissue of origin. So if you, I'm going to use other examples that people might have a better sense of. If you had, I think most people know that breast tissue is glandular. It's glandular because it makes milk. And so if you have a breast cancer, it can look like glands. And if you have a tumor that still has architectural elements of glandular architecture with cells that are fairly homogeneous in appearance, that might be a well-differentiated breast cancer, meaning it's that the tumor cells themselves are trying to emulate the tissue of origin. On the other extreme, we have poorly differentiated cancers, and those cancers no longer look like or even attempt to look like the tissue of origin. Poorly differentiated tumors have cells that are sort of erratic. They're completely a broad spectrum of sizes and nuclear shapes. They're not bearing any close relationship one to another, so they're not forming any distinct architectural pattern. They're just growing like sheets of cells in a very chaotic background.
Here's Dr. Thor Hefdonarsson, an oncologist at the Mayo Clinic in Minnesota.
Tumor differentiation has more to do about how the tumor cells look. Do they look quiet, well-behaved, or do they look angry? So you just, the pathologist, an experienced pathologist, can look at this and just look at the slides and tell immediately if this is like an aggressively behaving cancer or not.
Now, the reason why the terms well-differentiated and poorly differentiated are so important clinically is because the poorly differentiated tumors grow faster, are much more aggressive, they spread early and often. The well-differentiated tumors tend to grow slower. They tend not to spread as fast. And so when I talk about this with patients, I think of well-differentiated as well-behaved, poorly differentiated as poorly behaved, and they're less likely to respond to normal growth controls.
Another key piece of data is a tumor's grade, which is a measurement of how fast its cells are reproducing.
So the grade refers to how fast dividing are the cells. There are three grades primarily, grade 1, grade 2, and grade 3. And these are based on a couple of features. One is the Ki-67, and the other is the mitotic index. They are both reflections of how fast dividing these cells are. Slowly dividing is good, and fast dividing is bad. So the Ki-67 is a special stain. It's a protein stain that the pathologists apply to all of the cells that they're looking at. And the slower dividing cells pick up the stain less frequently, and the faster dividing cells pick up the stain more quickly, or more frequently, I should say. So when you're looking at, think of you're looking at a picture with a bunch of dots. The protein will show as a dot. There will just be a few dots for a grade one, and the Ki-67 is graded on a scale of 1 to 100, so that's 0 to 2. A grade two neuroendocrine tumor will have a Ki-67 of 2 to 20, so there will be an intermediate number of dots. And then a grade 3 neuroendocrine carcinoma has a Ki-67 of greater than 20 up to 100. And so that will have many dots that you see when you're looking at that stain on a pathology slide. The mitotic index, however, actually does look at mitoses, which is the act of cell division.
You have these condensed chromatin, which represents almost like tangles of string. And that's what a mitotic figure is. The pathologist counts the number of mitotic figures within a specific area, specifically 2 millimeters squared.
So that is also defined on a very similar scale to the Ki-67, so 0 to 2, 3 to 20, and greater than 20. So they are similar and complementary markers, but slightly different scales, but we use both of them together.
This grading system is used for all NETs, except those that start in the lungs, which have their own slightly different system.
With respect to lung carcinoids, pathologists have never been able to agree on what a Ki-67 cutoff should be for different grades. They all fight with each other. Should it be 5%? Should it be 10%? What is the limit for grade one? Nobody knows. So the pathologists to this day are using the WHO classification system, which was developed in about 2010. They're divided instead of grade one, grade two, grade three, like we do for the intestinal ones. We talk about typical carcinoid, atypical carcinoid, and high-grade neuroendocrine tumors.
Grade has a lot to do with how NETs are treated and with overall prognosis. Grade three or high-grade NETs are very different than lower-grade NETs.
Grade 1 and 2 tend to have a better prognosis on the order of many years. The very aggressive, fast-growing grade 3 tumors could have a prognosis of months to a year or so. So very different than the grade 1 and 2 tumors.
But please keep in mind that within these grades, particularly within grade 3, there's a wide range of situations.
Grade 3 is a mixed bag. If somebody has 25, 30, 40% of the cells dividing, that's a different disease than if 95% of the cells are dividing. Treatments are completely different.
The grade of your tumor is not the whole story. It's one piece in a wide tapestry of information gathered from different kinds of tests and imaging. You and your doctors will use all this information to make decisions about how to most effectively deal with your tumor. No one test or one scan will give you the whole picture of what's happening. NETs are complex. No two are alike, and even within that one tumor, there can be a range of aggressiveness between the different cells.
You should use your head. If you have a tumor, doctor tells you it's grade one on a biopsy. Read by a good pathologist, he says grade one. And the cancer has doubled in size in 3 months. That's not grade one. That's a cancer which is growing pretty fast. The reason that we see this type of thing is a biopsy is just a little speck. If you do a endoscopic ultrasound of a pancreas and do a fine needle aspiration and you say, now I have a diagnosis of a pancreatic neuroendocrine tumor, okay, that's being based on a few cells you suck into a needle. But meanwhile, there's a whole tumor mass. Some areas in that mass might be actually pretty high grade and you might not even know it. So you have to use your head.
The bottom line is that to understand your NET and treat it properly, you really need to get a range of viewpoints and opinions from doctors who are trained to look at your disease from different angles and using different diagnostic techniques.
Cancer care is by definition very multidisciplinary. Often patients need a surgery and chemotherapy and radiation or other procedures. I would say that NET care in particular really requires many disciplines involved. You can imagine also if someone has hormone secretion, they need an endocrinologist. It really requires bringing all of those folks together.
Here's Dr. Eric Nakakura, a surgeon at the University of California, San Francisco.
So I think the core group is going to be surgeons, if a surgery's in play, the medical oncologists, if any kind of systemic therapies in play, the radiologists, you're going to help with the characterization diagnosis, the pathologists who are critical to confirming the diagnosis, and in some neuroendocrine tumors, this can be very critical in getting the diagnosis right. Also, nuclear medicine physicians play a key role with new therapies such as peptide receptor radiotherapy, and also with PET or functional imaging. Interventional radiologists play a key role in what's called liver-directed therapy for patients with liver disease. So I think those are your core group that you want to have. But there's also nutritionists that are very important, especially with patients with carcinoid syndrome, helping to control the diarrhea or avoiding foods that can make the symptoms worse. Symptom management, especially in patients with issues with pain, diarrhea, weight loss, things like that.
Because NETs are different from other kinds of cancer, it's critically important that you work with doctors who specialize in treating NET patients. On the website for this episode, we'll post a list of hospitals around the country where you can be seen by some of the world's most experienced specialists in treating neuroendocrine tumors, maybe even some of the same doctors you've heard speak on this series. At specialty NET treatment centers, sometimes your case will be discussed and reviewed by what's called a tumor board, a multidisciplinary group who work together to present you with a plan of action for combating your particular cancer with all of its specific characteristics.
And so a tumor board is really a panel of experts from different disciplines. So in our case, we have a pathologist who lets us see the slides under the microscope, which is actually really great. We have a radiologist who will review the CT scans or the MRIs. We have a nuclear medicine physician who will re-review those gallium DOTA PETs. We have medical oncologists, surgeons, interventional radiologists, so all in one room. And we will present the case of a patient. And that really helps us, specifically if there's a question, but I think that it's pretty good routinely to discuss patients in this forum. I always learn something, and I think it ensures that the patient is really getting multiple opinions to help determine the next best step.
We strongly encourage you to work with a knowledgeable and experienced NET doctor, even if you live far away, because after an initial set of consultations, they may even be able to collaborate with your local medical center to give you the best care possible.
Many patients live far, far away from NET expert centers, so I would say the majority of the patients that come see me live a many-hour drive away. So we often work with their local community oncologists and partner with them to implement the plan. I tell patients that I think that's really the best of both worlds. If they come to us for scans and regular input to get input on at times of key decisions, and then they get the care implemented closer to home.
And when you are working with an experienced team of NET doctors, it's important that you come prepared. Taking a little time to work with your current oncologist or primary care doctor to assemble as much information as you can about what you've already done and who you've already seen.
So the really big thing is, you know, making sure that all the tests that have been done since diagnosis are brought to the visit. That sounds like a very daunting task for someone that's just been diagnosed, because they probably can't even remember all the tests that they've had, because it's usually such a whirlwind process. But the big thing, the really big things would be, you know, any pathology reports, if they've had biopsies or if they've had surgery already, making sure those make it to the appointment, any imaging that's been done. We usually request the discs of the imaging so we can look at it ourselves and have our radiologist take a look if we feel it's necessary. And then, you know, if they're being sent to us by an oncologist or whoever discovered this diagnosis, any notes from them, because it's someone that's probably been seeing them for a long time and maybe they've had symptoms for years, but they couldn't quite figure out why. And it's important for us to know how long those symptoms have been going on. And then any lab tests that have been done, of course, we want those as well. We also don't want to double back on anything that's already been done in addition to getting that base knowledge of their case.
My name is Mark Lewis. I'm a doctor, I'm a medical oncologist, and I'm the director of gastrointestinal oncology at Intermountain Healthcare, which is a healthcare system based in Utah. I got involved with the Neuroendocrine Tumor Research Foundation and the board in the most selfish way imaginable, which is that I have neuroendocrine tumors myself. So as I was into my medical training, I developed abdominal pain, and doctors probably shouldn't diagnose themselves. I thought I had appendicitis. I didn't. I was even able to convince myself that some of my symptoms were due to other things, stress. Being a doctor, I thought that's why I was exhausted. It turns out I actually had, you know, tumors growing in my body. I had high calcium, and that clicked for me because my father had had high calcium as well. And his doctors had told him it was he was consuming too much dairy. And it turns out that was a clue that was missed. And so our family curse, if you will, is multiple endocrine neoplasia type 1. So that's an autosomal dominant disorder. So it runs through generations with a 50-50 inheritance pattern. So for instance, I have two children, and the way the coin flipped, one of them has MEN1 and one of them doesn't. So I'm here and involved in NRF, both because I'm affected, but more importantly for me, because I'm the parent of a child affected with neuroendocrine tumors. And I'm deeply invested on a personal and professional level in making sure he has a healthy future. I want treatment for him as he grows older to look vastly different and less invasive than what I've had to go through or what my patients are having to go through. The advice I would give to a newly diagnosed NET patient is, first of all, take heart, you're not alone. The psychological burden of being diagnosed with a rare illness, and I can speak to this personally, is that you feel unique in a bad way. You feel like you're the only person to go through this, and that's obviously a bit histrionic, but that is how it feels at first. Then what you discover is that, especially online, and there's good and bad things about social media and search engines, there are other people like you, perhaps much more like you than you may have realized. And so I would encourage them to carefully seek out online community and support. And then finally, I would ask them to vet information. We are pretty good these days at rating things, meaning that I can go on my phone and decide where I want to eat tonight based on a restaurant review. People should be as discerning when it comes to medicine and research. Again, the first thing that pops up in your Google search may not be reliable, and it does take some time and experience to separate the wheat from the chaff. Dr. Google is a dangerous, dangerous thing because it's a free search engine. But what's not free are the way the results are prioritized. And so people can pay money to have their results rise to the top, often for profit. And so they're not necessarily serving you the best treatment. They might be serving you the treatment that's in their best interest. As a patient and as a parent affected by NETs, personally and in my family, I am very grateful and hopeful. And that's one of the best things you can say, I think, in oncology. We're sometimes viewed as very pessimistic. I would argue the opposite. I think we can see how far we've come. We still have a long way to go, but there's real progress occurring here and hereafter, and that should spark hope.
Something to keep close to your heart in all of this is don't panic. Take your time and get informed. Don't rush to treatment before you've really learned about what's going on and why. Here's Dr. Blaise Polite, a clinical oncologist at the University of Chicago.
Any cancer diagnosis, certainly neuroendocrine is one of those, is almost never a medical emergency, right? There are exceptions, but cancer diagnosis is almost never an emergency. It's an urgency, but it's not an emergency, and you have time to get to the right place, to the right center, to the right group of people looking at things. And, you know, as you see all this information, all the things that we have to think about, how important it is that we can talk to each other, do tumor boards if we have to call our colleagues across the country, do those type of things to make sure that we put a plan in place for you that makes the most sense.
You are going to be presented with many opinions and many options. In the end, the course of treatment you want to pursue is going to be your decision. It's important that you feel good about the doctors you end up choosing, that you like them and trust them, and feel that you can ask them questions and get meaningful answers.
You want to be able to have a comfortable relationship with them, make sure that they're kind of hearing you, and to make sure that everything's being laid out for you so you have a good understanding of things.
Getting in as many opinions as possible is critical. To be fully informed of what your options are, realizing that there is no one right answer. For example, you may go to one institution, they may say surgery. You may go to another institution, they may say never surgery. And you have to listen to the pros and cons or the arguments made in favor or not in favor of an intervention or treatment and decide for yourself what do you feel is right for your body and yourself based on the information you were provided.
We are going to spend the next several episodes talking about all of the major treatment options currently offered for NET patients in the United States. It's our hope that by listening to this series and reviewing our additional online resources, you'll continue to learn about NETs and better understand the disease that you're living with and dealing with, emerging as a listener who is NET-wise. Thank you, listener, for tuning in to NETWISE. My name is Lauren Heider. I'm the Director of Education and Outreach for the Neuroendocrine Tumor Research Foundation. I executive produced and co-wrote this series. It was produced and co-written by David Hoffman of Citizen Race Car. This episode was made possible by the generous support of Advanced Accelerator Applications, a Novartis company, Lexicon Pharmaceuticals, and the Vincent E. Taylor Patient Education Fund. Special thanks to everyone we interviewed for this episode. We are grateful for your expertise. This is a production of the NET Research Foundation. We're committed to improving the lives of patients, families, and caregivers affected by neuroendocrine cancer. We fund research to discover cures and more effective treatments, and we provide information and educational resources. Please visit us at netrf.org.
This podcast is not intended as and shall not be relied upon as medical advice. The Neuroendocrine Tumor Research Foundation encourages all users to discuss any information found here with their oncologist, physician, and/or appropriate qualified health professional. Listening to this podcast does not constitute a patient-physician relationship. The Neuroendocrine Tumor Research Foundation does not represent that any information provided here should supplant the reasoned, informed advice of a patient's oncologist, physician, or appropriate qualified health professional.